Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Don't need a motion to do that, right? Got the minutes before us. Representative Heinzelman, would you move the minutes from March 20th, please?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Any additions or corrections to the minutes, members? Okay, all those in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those, the minutes are approved. First up today, we have Representative Fenton with House File 3819, and I would move that 3819 be re-referred and sent to GovOps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Fenton.
House File 3819 is proposed.
Members, we keep it quiet in here, please. Okay. Guests.
House File 3819 is proposed legislation that was brought to me by the Ramsey Conservation District and the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. The Ramsey Conservation District petitioned the Minnesota Board of Soil and Water Resources to discontinue and to transfer duties and authorities of the RCD to the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. And with me today is Paul Gardner. Paul Gardner, a board member of the Ramsey Conservation District, and also Ramsey County Commissioner Board Chair Jim McDonough, to testify on behalf of this legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fenton. My name is Paul Gardner from Shoreview in Ramsey County. I'm one of five elected supervisors for the Ramsey Conservation District, which is our county's version of a soil and water conservation district. Mr. Chair, it looks like you have a hotter bill than ours, and so did you want the Reader's Digest version in 60 seconds or so? And I'm sure your CA, who's been up late, is saying yes.
Yeah, they have.
Yep.
Very good.
And we'll get to questions if we need to. Thank you.
Great. I'm pleased to say that the staff of the Ramsey Conservation District has been doing great work with some of the money you've made available, both in your budget and through competitive grants through Bowser, to be self-funded and getting really efficient outcomes for improving our environment, our soil and water in Ramsey County. The bad news is our board has just had a prolonged period of dysfunction over the last year where we have not been able to accomplish some of the basic things that you would expect a group of elected officials to do, and so by a majority vote last month, the supervisors petitioned the county to dissolve the board itself and transfer the staff, the duties and the assets of the organization to the county. And the county, as far as I know, has unanimously agreed to do that, and we've been working with Bowser to make sure the transition doesn't hinder our ability to achieve efficient outcomes for things like water quality in the county. I'll leave it there, and happy to answer any questions after Commissioner McDonough.
Sure. Commissioner McDonough, please. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
It was a long drive for you, huh?
Yeah.
Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner. I chair the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. On behalf of the Ramsey County Board, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Ramsey County Board supports the Ramsey County Conservation District's petition to discontinue and transfer its duties and authorities to the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. Our organization has been aware of the evolving situation on the Board of Supervisors and the long-term diligent efforts that the Board of Supervisors have taken to remedy or improve the situation. As Mr. Gardner testified, ultimately these efforts were unsuccessful. At this juncture, we believe it is in the best interest of our residents, stakeholders, and resources that the Conservation District be empowered to continue their important work uninterrupted. This was affirmed by the commissioners in a public county board workshop held earlier this year. Ramsey County is committed to maintaining and enhancing the quality of soil and water for a healthy, clean environment for our residents. The responsibilities authorities of the Ramsey County Conservation District clearly align with Ramsey County's vision and mission and goals. Through the alignment of our environmental health, public works, and other departments, Ramsey County is prepared to implement the conservation practices identified in Minnesota Chapter 103C. In closing, the Ramsey County Board supports the Ramsey County Conservation District's petition to discontinue its duties and authorities to the Ramsey County Board, and that we have the organizational alignment and capabilities to continue this important work on behalf of our community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
You're welcome. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to acknowledge and support the staff of the Ramsey Conservation Board. My experience with them is that they do high-quality work, get the job done, some really innovative projects, and the management is, not the executive director, but the board management, I think has been a challenge, and that's why the bill is here. I support this bill. I have a couple questions of Bowser just on how this would work, Mr. Chair, if that's possible.
I think that's possible.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Angie Becker-Fidelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And with me today, Kevin Bogalke, a Regional Section Manager for the region.
Representative Hampson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Becker-Kadelka. So the bill, as it's written, is amending law relating to Ramsey County. It is not, is it amending boilerplate soil and water law, or is it specific here? I'm wondering about precedent. Is this affecting precedent with all soil and water districts, or is this written to be only for Ramsey?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, members, this is in Chapter 383A, which is the Ramsey County law, and only impacts Ramsey County. The soil and water districts and counties throughout the state have unique relationships, and being able to still have that local determination of how a district might support a county or how a county might support a district is important. Therefore, this is only in Ramsey County law. It's a unique situation.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Becker-Kadelka. Does the action of the Ramsey Board of Supervisors set a precedent with other soil and water districts where a majority vote could dissolve, say, the district in Dakota County or Rock County or Blue Earth County? Is that precedent there if we pass this law?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, members, this specific legislation, it applies to Ramsey County only.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Becker-Kadelka, would Ramsey County, if they have the high-quality staff that have been working on soil and water conservation district projects, would they still be eligible for the grants and all the other actions, funds, technical assistance opportunities that come through Board of Water and Soil Resources for the other soil and water districts?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, that is a great question, and we have been working proactively with the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Districts, and with the Ramsey Conservation District to make sure that the citizens of Ramsey County are still served throughout this entire process. And so the county has been very proactive to make sure that the duties and powers are continued and not left in limbo, and they would be eligible than for those associated cost-share grants.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, just to drill down on, so you're working on it, but is would the law change, would they still be eligible for those grants?
If the law, Mr. Chair, members, if the law goes through, then absolutely they would be eligible.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Another testifier, okay? Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pierre Ouellette with Gulf Public, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I'll be very brief. I want to say that we're very disappointed that one of the Soil and Water Conservation Districts is taking the drastic action of dissolution, but we're grateful that Ramsey County has continued the work of soil and water conservation in their county, and ultimately that's the most important thing, that the work is going to get done. We also respect the self-determination of the Soil and Water Conservation District elected officials. And while we all worked hard for a different outcome, we understand that the unfortunate situation brought the need for some drastic action. We are grateful for the legislation, and particularly the part that would allow for a reestablishment of a district someday, if that's possible. But we felt we needed to remind everybody here today of the important work that soil and water conservation districts are doing across the state every day with fully functional and engaged boards of elected officials who direct expert staff, partner with, and are greatly relied upon by their counties. make the work happen on the ground, and are partners with landowners in a way that regulatory agencies and perhaps counties can't. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Excuse me. Representative Becker-Pin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure which one of you can answer this question, but my concern is just that the residents of Ramsey County still have the same degree of responsiveness and service when it comes to these issues when they have questions about things. Is there a plan in place to communicate to the public who they would contact with questions going forward? You know, if we're used to emailing Mr. Gardner about something or one of the other supervisors, is there a plan to communicate to the public?
Mr. Gardner or Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Becker-Pin. One of the purposes of this legislation is so that there is uninterrupted service for what the conservation was doing, and I'll let Mr. Gardner talk more on the plan for contact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Becker-Pin. The transition is actually quite easy because the staff is already on. They're housed at Ramsey County Public Works already. They're on the phone IT and payroll systems there. So all the emails and the phone numbers are all going to be the same. When it comes to elected representation on behalf of taxpayers, property owners, and voters, when I was liberated from this body in 2010 and I was asked to run for the Conservation Board, I asked the question, why do we have this board when we have three really robust watershed districts and a very good water management organization covering about 95% of the county anyway? Those boards of managers are appointed either by, in the case of watershed districts, by the county, who are elected officials, and the WMO directors are appointed by cities. So you have some accountability anyway through elected officials in that fashion. Of course, you can always check with me. I'm a volunteer master water steward in our area and happy to help with local projects.
Okay. So we're reducing the size of government in Ramsey County.
Thank you.
Becker-Pin.
No further questions.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Fenton, any closing comments on your bill?
Just thank you for your time, members.
Okay. With that, I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3819 to GovOps. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
We're moving on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next. Oh, there he is. Okay. Thank you. Representative Grosso, House File 3907. It sounds familiar.
It should.
I will move that. My intention is to lay House File 3907 over for possible inclusion.
Get on my laptop.
Test the fires. Thank you. Just a second, there's a map being handed out, Representative Grosso. Okay. Ooh, technology. Alrighty, Mr. Chair. All right. Thank you, Representative Grosso, to House File 3907.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for letting us be with you this morning. House File 3907 came before you last session, and you gave these landowners that are with me here some reprieve or some relief from the DNR and the AG's office taking civil action against them to gain access to a wildlife management area that DNR controlled just to the north of these gentlemen's property.
Okay, so Representative Grosso,
Members, just for your reference on the map that's in front of you, so as he's going through this, if you take a look at here where the railroad track is coming down like this, there's a block of land right here where the road curves. It says Tatera. I believe that's the property we're talking about, correct?
Yes, sir.
Sorry about
that.
Thank you. Yep.
And if you look at the screen, if you look at the screen above you or around you here, you can see this area. And this is the property that we're talking about. And to gain access to the land, they have a nice driveway that which is kept by the property owners, which they had permission to use. Some things changed, and that's why this bill is being presented. This bill is being presented to the Commissioner of Natural Resources must not initiate a civil action or otherwise seek to obtain access to land administered by the Commissioner via private road connected to County Road 27 located in Clearwater County, Township 147, Range 32, and Range 33. What happened here was they had an agreement, and some dynamics changed in the area to where the property owners placed a gate at the end of the driveway. And it was to protect home and property from some extra traffic that had been coming into the area and essentially doing some partying on private property and leaving garbage behind. So they decided, you know, with the dynamics changing, the dynamics that changed was a casino went in just to the east of the property owner's land, and traffic increased, and unwanted and uninvited traffic started using their driveway. So the property owner placed the gate there, and the DNR took exception to it and demanded that they give them access. If you look for the property at the property just to the north of the corner, this is also controlled by the DNR, which gives them land access to the property that we're talking about. They could just go a half mile or a quarter mile up the road and gain access to their wildlife management area via their own controlled property. So, with that being said, I'll let these gentlemen tell you the story of what went on there.
Good morning. Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Daniel Millenacker. I am a co-owner of a 29.5-acre parcel of property located west of Bagley, Minnesota, in the southeast quarter, northeast quarter, section 32, township 147 north, range 38 west, Popple Township, Clearwater County, Minnesota. Seated with me today are two of my neighbors, Mr. Mark Tatera and Mr. Bob O'Dear, residents of rural Bagley, Minnesota, who own adjoining properties. I'm here today to offer testimony to this committee to describe the insolent actions of the Department of Natural Resources to force open a gate which we erected along a private farm road which borders our properties and leads to a state wildlife management area. The DNR claims that it has prescriptive rights to use the private farm road for public access to the wildlife management area. There are a total of 7 private landowners affected by the DNR's action. This is not the first time that you have heard about this incident. During the 2017 legislative session, this body passed a bill signed by Governor Dayton prohibiting the DNR from bringing a lawsuit against my neighbors and me to force open the gate and allow the public to use our private farm road. By law, this prohibition expires on July 1, 2018. I'm here today to ask you to permanently extend this prohibition against the DNR from taking our private property. Let me explain to you the history of this private farm road. This road was constructed decades ago as a one-lane access from a private nursery business to the north extending to U.S. Highway 2. It was built on private property to be used during the springtime when vehicle weight restrictions were in effect on county roadways. The farm road begins at its intersection with County Road 27, directly due west of the newly constructed casino. The farm road no longer extends to U.S. Highway 2. No public money was ever used to construct or maintain this one-lane private road. Today, the remaining segment of this farm road is used by landowners to access their own property. The farm road remained ungated until 2015 when the owners discovered that trespassers had used it to access the wooded area and illegally dispose of trash and household furnishings in the woods, access walking trails with four-wheel drive vehicles, and vandalize property. Fearful of the owner's personal safety from lack of control over who was entering the property, the owners constructed a gate across the private farm road. On the north end of the farm road is the Island Lake FMHA Wildlife Management Area Clearwater County Unit. The WMA was established in the 1990s. When the gate was installed in 2015, the WMA could no longer be accessed from the private farm road. We had no reason prior to 2015 to gate the road. On August 22, 2016, the Northwest Region DNR Area Wildlife Supervisor, escorted by two armed conservation officers, confronted landowners at the gate and demanded that it be unlocked. The Area Wildlife Supervisor was prepared to cut the lock with a bolt cutter in order to force open the gate and allow access to the WMA. The landowners protested, and the state official and conservation officers left without cutting the lock. During February 2017, the state attorney general's office informed one of the landowners by phone that the landowners would be sued in a court of law if the lock was not removed and the gate opened. This threat was formalized in a letter of March 23, 2017 from the Minnesota Attorney General's office delivered to an attorney retained by the landowners. The Attorney General's office instructed the landowners to settle or be faced with a lawsuit to be filed by the state of Minnesota to force open the gate. The state argument unfolds only because the landowners allowed the farm road to remain open for use to the public beginning at the time that the WMA was established. As of today's date, none of the landowners have been served legal papers due to the prohibition entered into state law during the 2017 legislative session. As affected landowners, we thank you for taking the action that you did to give us 1 year of peace, but the job is not yet finished. That's the reason that my neighbors and I are here in this committee room today. In this testimony, I speak for all seven of the affected landowners. Personally, I find it appalling that the DNR finds it acceptable to take private property for its own use. What's much worse is the fact that a DNR official showed up on our property and was ready to cut the lock with the bolt cutter he brought along with, under the watchful eyes of two armed conservation officer escorts. I ask the committee to respect an individual landowner's rights to control who may access their private property. Ironically, the DNR in their website instruction to the public choosing to access WMA property states, quote, boundary is approximate. Please respect private property and obey boundary signs, end quote. The issue that I have just outlined to you proves that the DNR does not even follow its own rules. Another note of fact in this testimony is that the state of Minnesota owns property approximately 1/2 mile to the west, which, if developed into a road or walking trail from County Road 27, would provide access to the WMA. Such a move by the state would solve the access problem by using its own land. The landowner's position to this committee is, quote, please respect our right to control access to and across our own property, end quote. I'm certain that I hear a chorus of like sentiment from farmers and ranchers in Clearwater County and across the state of Minnesota who find the government's intent of taking private land to be offensive, if not downright unconstitutional. The bottom line is this. If someone were traipsing across your own backyard, spewing trash, car parts, derelict television sets, rutting your garden and your yard with vehicle tracks and vandalizing your gates, would you allow that to continue? Of course not. And we are not willing to allow that to continue either. This is the reason why we are asking for the committee's support to solve this problem. I respectfully offer this testimony on behalf of all affected landowners. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if at any point did you reach out to law enforcement, what efforts are made by law enforcement to enforce the separate issue of the trespassing on your land?
Former Deputy Grossel, you want to answer that?
Can I?
Go ahead, to the testifiers.
Ironically, trespass issues are addressed by the Department of Natural Resources through the conservation officer. If, as a landowner, I have an issue with hunters trespassing across my property, the first point of contact is going to be my local conservation officer. And these were the gentlemen that were there escorting the area wildlife manager who insisted on us opening the gate. So it's ironic. The other call that we could have made would have been to the sheriff's office of Clearwater County, but then we have two law enforcement entities, and how do you address that? How do you deal with something like that?
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is the whether the DNR legally has access to that road and whether there are other members of the public who are dumping trash and driving on your private property and breaking the law are separate issues. And so I'm asking if you've contacted the Sheriff's Department separately from the incident with the gate and the threat to cut the gate, when there was the dumping of trash, and, you know, have police, you know, have reports been made of the trespassing crimes that have been committed? It doesn't sound like those were hunters. It sounds like that was something else.
Trespassers. And you're
Mr.
asking...
Mr. Miller.
You were asking if reports were made to law enforcement at that moment. And I defer to the residents in that area.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Robert O'Neill.
Proceed.
To answer your question, yes, law enforcement was called on one occasion when we had to pick up TV sets and various garbage. Yes.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way that you framed this is that the reason that you put up the gate was the trespassing and the garbage dumping, which obviously none of us want on our private land, completely understand that. But it seems that this bill is isn't actually getting at the root of the problem, which is the behavior of people who are breaking the law on your property. And whether the DNR legally has access to that road would be something that, I mean, you can shake your head, but there are long-standing property law doctrines and law about whether you can continue to have access to something that you've historically been granted access to. And I think that's, I imagine that's likely what any potential lawsuit would be looking at. And so I just would be careful in conflating the bad behavior by folks who are dumping and trespassing isn't the fault of the DNR. You know, those are really separate issues that you're looking at. And I would hope that law enforcement in the community would be helpful in holding people accountable who are dumping stuff on your property.
Representative Russell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative Finn. The question of the garbage being dumped, that was addressed through law enforcement, as it should have been. They put up the gate to prevent that. They were willing still to allow access, but when they weren't around, the gate would be locked. And the DNR did not want that. They wanted to still use the road that they had received permission to use. They don't have anything other than the agreement between the landowners and themselves to use that road. And they had a good working relationship. But as I said, the dynamics changed. They wanted to protect their homes and their properties from future dumpings from other people coming in who might be bad actors. And so they put up the gate. The DNR decided to sue them to gain access, which was not necessary to do because, like you said, just approximately a quarter mile to a half mile to the west, They have another easement. They have more property that would that hooks them up to the property that they were seeking to gain access to. Only it doesn't have a well-kept private driveway to take them to it. So that's that. In for this bill, it is not a question of the bad actors. It's a question of a public service entity, DNR, taking private citizens and dragging them into the AG's office, dragging them into court, civil court, and suing them. And this is something that shouldn't be done. We are all public servants. The DNR are public servants. Every other department, they're public servants. We shouldn't be taking tax dollars, their own tax dollars, and suing them until they run out of money, until they get their way. This is the point of this bill, is to protect our citizens from being unduly drug into court and sued.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, my understanding is that it's public land that they're trying to get access to that
yes.
belongs to all of us, so including you all and everyone here and all Minnesotans. It's public land. And the thing with property law is that it's tricky. It doesn't always come down to a spoken agreement back and forth. You know, there's, you know, centuries-long common law in the way that property law is enforced. And so I understand that it feels like it's a taking to the folks here, but I'd imagine that likely the legal question is whether it is. And that's likely what the DNR's action, I'm sure, is not because they're concerned about their access to the land. It's the access of the public to the public land. So, to me, it makes sense that it's a legal question that they're trying to have answered. I was just saying, I worry about the precedent we're setting with individually bringing legislation to stop the DNR from helping the public access our public land. You know, I certainly understand, you know, there's some unique circumstances and it's frustrating to folks that you've got the bad actors that are not being held accountable. But there is a legal question here and we're circumventing that with this legislation.
Representative Grossman. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. If this piece of property, this wildlife management area, were landlocked, if this was the only way into that property, I would agree with that. I would agree with what you're saying. But it's not. This is not the only route. This is not the only land access to that wildlife management. As I stated, you know, with the piece of property just to the west of these gentlemen's property that is also controlled by the DNR, they could easily go to that piece of property and access the wildlife management. So I would agree that if this is a piece of landlocked property that they have no other way to get to except through private lands surrounding it, then you work stuff out. But they don't have to. There's no reason for them to sue when they already have access on a piece of property that they already control. So I don't think we're setting any bad precedents with this bill, because it's merely protecting these people from unnecessary lawsuits.
Representative Beckman, I'll get to you in a second. See, Pat Rivers is here from DNR. You may have some comments, but go ahead, proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just finally, I would hope, Representative Grossel, that maybe we could work in the future in helping the DNR make that a reality. If the reality is that we need better access to that land, and you know, you're suggesting this property, this other adjoining property, is the way to do that, then I would hope that we can work together to make that reality, because it does sound like, you know, this is hindering access to that public land. So I would hope, you know, going forward, that's something we can all support then. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, the Representative. We have been working together, and that's why we have come to this point, is that we have been working together with the DNR, and they have been better to deal with in after our meetings, and after it was brought up that, you know, this is an issue that is changed, It's an issue that I'm looking at it from a public safety issue for the safety of these people's homes and their properties. Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, thank you for this opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Pat Rivers, Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Again, we have, and the public has been using that road since 1993 when the land was acquired. In 2015, when the garbage first started showing up, or when the landowners put the gate up, our wildlife manager met with them, and there seemed to be agreement that we could have an arrangement where the gate would be kept locked outside of the hunting season, and we could open it for the public and for management outside of the closed season, which seemed like a reasonable compromise in this issue. And sometime before the bear season of 2015 started, the gate was locked, and that option was no longer apparently viable. In March of 2017, the Attorney General's Office provided an easement document to the landowners so that we could work through a less expensive option to try to come to resolution on access to this road. We also asked for alternatives if that was not an acceptable option. We did not hear back from the landowners at that time, and then we had the legislation from last year. You know, related to the access to the west, that is somewhat irrelevant to the legal access that we believe we have on the access road in question. That is trust fund land and is not quite the same as what the 20-year use is just a bit to the east.
Representative Huber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to Representative Grossel. You know, it seems to me, and in view of what Director Rivers just mentioned, but it seems to me that a way to get a win-win situation around here would be the land to the west, I believe you said about a half mile, and if you could resolve those issues about trust fund lands and things, it would seem to me that we could easily appropriate some money for the DNR to make some improvements for road access and in that area, and everybody would be made whole. The landowners and the would no longer have to worry about the unauthorized access. The DNR would get its access to the wildlife management area, and perhaps appropriately, we would provide monies to construct that road, which probably wouldn't be very much because I'm assuming it's a one-lane gravel road. And I'm just wondering if you think that's a viable alternative, and if you would possibly sponsor a bill for some monies for that.
Representative Grossel.
Just doing some conversing over here while we're listening to that, you know, it is a good idea, and I think that's something that could be explored. I wish that would have been explored before suing the landowners. It was just mentioned that there is a railroad crossing on the private drive, but of course it could be accessed. People can go over railroad crossings. I've walked over them all my life, and I've been able to get to hunting areas or been able to get wherever I needed to. And there's some hunters that go up into this area, which really isn't there's really not a whole lot there when you go out and look at it. And so for these people to walk a little bit in the woods, it's not that bad. I hunted in Representative Finn could probably familiar with this area, the Bowens Point on Lake Winnie. Now that road has been cut off. That used to be about a 7 to 10 mile round trip walking in the woods. My 60-year-old brothers, myself, and one of our 7-year-old brother-in-laws, we walked that. And it's crawling over blowdowns, it's crawling over rocks, it's crawling over everything. Okay? We walked that every deer season, probably 3-4 times a deer season. This is probably a quarter mile or a half mile to this piece of property over pretty much pasture to get to that WMA. I think people are, if they're hunting, they're healthy enough to walk to that point. to put a parking area, that would be helpful for people to still have access to that property. Doesn't have to go through the private drive anymore.
Well, this is a mess that's been created. You know, I own property immediately adjacent to a WMA, and the local wildlife manager has asked me a couple of different times for permission to cross my property to create a fire break and so forth, and we've worked together on this. It's sad that we've gotten to this point. By the way, Representative Grossel, too, when you are crossing those railroad tracks, make sure you don't have your earbuds in and you're not looking at your smartphone, okay? But, members, it is my intention to lay this bill over. I want to wrap this up quickly here, so if there's any quick closing comments, we've got a couple other things to do today. I want to respect the fact that the gentlemen have traveled down from Bagley. It's about halfway home to my place, so go ahead.
My name is Mark Katera, and I'm a dairy farmer right there at Bagley. The corner that the DNR can access off of County Road 27 is a 7-acre piece of pie. If you look on your map real close, it's a 7-acre piece of pie. I currently lease that from the state of Minnesota, and I pay a 5-year lease on it. I'll be more than glad to give up that lease to the DNR and move part of my farming operation to the private road that me and my neighbor Bob own. When Grossel talks about safety concerns, if I move part of my farming operation, I'm going to move on that road. Well, I'm sure it's not going to build and expand my farm along that road if I don't live there and I can't protect it. That's my, and it's my son that lives in North Dakota that's going to come home and farm someday. You know, that's where we're going to expand, is along that road. Well, I'm not going to expand, or we cannot expand along that road, our farming operation, if we can't protect it.
Thanks for protection. Dr. Rivers.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's not just hunter access, but we do need management access. So if we consider an access to the west, we do need to consider getting vehicles in there so we can do proper management of the WMA.
I'm sure that Ray will be easy to work with. Yep. Closing comments, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. And this bill is just to continue to give relief to these landowners and to protect them from being sued and dragged into court and having their own tax dollars used against them. So I'd like to make sure that this bill keeps going.
It will. Thank you. Okay, with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony, everyone. Thanks for making the trip down here. Okay, next, the guy with the fancy vest.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Grossel has House File 2940, and I will move to re-refer House File 2940 to the, Bliss, I'm sorry, to the General Register, and we have the DE1 amendment. Representative Bliss.
I'm sorry, sir.
Would you like me to move your DE for you?
Yes, I would, please.
Okay. So I'll move the DE1 amendment to House File 2940. Discussion to the amendment. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed? Okay. The amendment is adopted. The bill's in the order that the author would like. Representative Bliss, to your bill 2940.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 2940 is a fairly simple bill. We're just saying that the MPCA cannot raise water fees without legislative approval. And, you know, back in 2015, the MPCA had come forward to us requesting the ability to raise their water fees, and they weren't granted that that right back then. We don't believe that they have that right, and it actually it's stated in statute that they don't have that right. They decided that they did, and they tried to move forward with rulemaking to raise the rates, and they asked for public comment, which you have the public comments in your packet. And I've heard that $28 million was the number they'd hoped to raise on that fee, and that's a large number. Whether or not they need that fee, that's going to be a discussion for another day. We're just here to clarify in statute that the MPCA does not have the ability to raise their water fees without legislative approval. Remember last year we had the DNR come in and ask for permission to raise the fees, which we gave them for hunting licenses and such. So in a nutshell, that's what my bill does.
Okay, Representative
Wagenius. So right now, the water fees do not cover the cost of the water permits. So who is subsidizing those permits right now?
Well, that would be through the general fund that they have.
No, there's no general fund money in the going to DNR for the permits.
The MPCA.
Okay, we'll work through the chair here.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
I think we're going to have to ask that question of PCA because I don't believe that's true.
Okay, Representative Bliss.
And again, Representative Wagenius, the question is not whether or not they need it; it's whether or not they have to come through the legislative body to get that approval.
Yeah, and that's not the point of the bill, but Representative Wagenius.
Okay, and I think the question is a little bit different. If the folks who are getting permits now are not paying the cost of the permit.
Can you speak into the microphone, please?
Okay. If the people who are getting permits now are not paying the cost of the permits, my question to you, and now I think to PCA, will be who is paying for that? Instead of the people who are getting the benefit of a permit. So I'll ask that question to them.
Okay. Well, and I would say that goes on all throughout state government. But PCA, correct, Ms. Gostin? Good morning. Identify yourself, and then we'll go back to Representative Wagenius' question.
For the record, my name is Greta Gothier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Good morning, Mr. Chairman
Good morning.
And members.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the water fees that are charged by PCA do not cover the full cost of your providing those water fees. And my question is, where does the money come from if it doesn't come from the people who are benefiting from getting the permit?
Ms. Gothier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wagenius. Members, there should be in your packet a handout from the MPCA that looks like this. It's two-sided, multicolor bar chart. If you want to turn to the first side, which has mostly green and blue bars, that says water quality programs funding up in the upper left-hand corner. That, Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius and members, that will show you where the funding comes from for our various programs. So we have seven water programs across the bottom there. You can see their feedlots, stormwater construction, stormwater industrial, that's for private companies, stormwater municipal for public entities, and then wastewater, industrial, municipal, and then SSTS, that's septics, subsurface sewage treatment systems or septics. So the green bar on here, the little black line across each of those bars shows you the amount of total costs that are covered by fee revenue for the various programs. I believe that, Madam Chair, it averages out totally over across all those programs to about 17% of our costs are covered by fees. If you look on the other side that's got multicolored, you can see at the top of each bar for each program, we tell you the percent for that program that fees cover. So, for example, if you look at the first one there, on the left-hand side, the feedlots, it's 9%. Stormwater construction, 40%. Industrial, 61%, and so on down the line. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to speak. I would be speaking to this chart in my testimony, so if you want me to just do my testimony, I can do that, or I can answer more questions.
Oh, okay, I was going to defer to Representative Wagenius, and she's nodding approval, which I usually do. So I will let you proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, House Bill 2940, today. And we do appreciate the DE amendment. It does improve the bill by narrowing it to water permits only. And it also brings it into conformance with the language that the Senate has. So I do appreciate that. First of all, let me state that that we do oppose this bill, as you might expect. And the commissioner has two main reasons for opposing the bill. First of all, the commissioner feels that currently the legislature has sufficient opportunities for oversight of our agency. There are many paths that exist currently for oversight, including hearings such as this, appropriations, legislation, reporting requirements, audits by the legislative auditor, and other forms of communication with the commissioner. The commissioner feels that the issue is not that further legislative oversight is necessary. Secondly, the second issue is that the agency has a structural imbalance in its budget, and that's what we have been trying to fix. So when the agency was created in 1967, the water permits were 50-50, 50% general fund, 50% fee revenue. That's how we started off back in the day. That had changed over time as costs went up, so that by 1992, it was about 25% fee revenue covered 25% or so of our permitting costs. So the legislature in 1992 examined all of these fees, all seven of them here, and they overhauled them and raised those fees. And that was the last time that the legislature overhauled all those fees and raised them comprehensively. So that was 26 years ago. The MPCA did try to come back about 10 years later, and my understanding is in the early 2000s, but there was not an appetite at the legislature at that time to look at fees. Finally, we came back again, and in 2007 and again in 2009, the legislature did give the agency authority to raise water fees. And so under the Pawlenty administration in 2009, the agency began that process and started raising some of the fees, and the ones that were raised in 2009 were some of the feedlot fees. Of course, the feedlots program is only one of the seven programs that we're responsible for by law. And right after those fees went up, of course, the Great Recession hit. And a decision was made in the Pawlenty administration to stop raising these fees because of the recession. So when the Dayton administration came in, the commissioners since then have also decided not to look at these fees because of the recession. In 2015, the commissioner did come and request authority from the legislature to raise these fees. That thought was that the recession was pretty much settled down by then, and perhaps we could start this process. But at the end of the day, the commissioner did not get that authority, and the commissioner came back. Now this year, after the governor instructed his cabinet members in the last 18 months or so of the administration to please find ways to put the budgets in better shape than we found them. So the commissioner looked at the agency's budget and saw that the structural imbalance in water fees was the biggest structural problem with our budget. So we started a preliminary rulemaking process last summer, and we got a lot of input. I should note that at the same time that those 26 years the fees did not change, there were new responsibilities put on the agency. For example, there were federal and state also responsibilities for stormwater. And so those were put on the agency with no funding source. And our general fund appropriation since 1990s has steadily declined as a percent of our overall budget. Also, there has been no inflationary increase even in our water fees since 1992. Of course, the exception is that in 2009, under the Plante administration, they did raise some of those ag fees, the feedlot fees. But aside from that, none of the rest of them have changed. So if you look at the handout, you can see that our fees do not cover the cost of providing services. And if you look at the first slide that I showed you, you can see that there are other sources that we're using. For example, we're using revenue from our environmental fund. Of course, the money from the environmental fund comes from the garbage tax that we all pay, on the solid waste tax we pay on our garbage. The Clean Water Fund is accelerating some of our work in stormwater and municipal wastewater permits. We're getting some federal funds, special revenue. We've gotten a little bit of LCCMR money. There is a little bit of, let me see here, general fund. I don't need, if you can see it over in the feedlot bar there, that gray portion at the top, and then in the municipal wastewater, you can see at the top of the bar there, there's a gray portion. That's general fund. So we do get some general fund to do this work. But if any of those sources were to change, and assuming the general fund amount is not going to change, we really have no choice to cover our costs but to look at fees. So we did preliminary discussion last summer. We asked our stakeholders for thoughts on this. We got a lot of thoughts back. You have the packet that we got. The commissioner then decided under 140101, the rulemaking chapter, commissioners can set up an advisory group if they need more advice on a rule. So the commissioner set up a water fee advisory committee. We had a lot of help from stakeholders in assembling that, and now that committee has been underway since January. It is made up of all the folks that are in all of these programs. So there are some folks that run septics businesses and feedlots. We have four representatives from the various livestock industries. We have a stormwater construction company that is on that group. We have municipal folks, and we have industrial permittees, including mines and including ethanol plants. So we've tried to reach out and get a good cross-section. There's 19 people on this group, and they've been looking at all the statutory regulations and all the legislative history, and they are meeting now and will continue to meet. The commissioners asked them to continue meeting through probably July or August, and he would like their work to inform the budget request for the 2021 biennium. So the commissioner is looking forward to receiving the advisory committee's recommendations. So lastly, the only other thing I would point out, Mr. Chairman, is that the training activities covered by this bill, some of the training activities covered in this bill are performed by entities other than us, namely the University of Minnesota. Much of the septics training is handled by the University of Minnesota via their on-site sewage treatment program. So this bill would subject changes to those U of M fees, and so that may become a slight glitch. But just a note. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I do have our CFO here, and I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Perkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Guth, here you described what you describe as the need for fees. But you started out your remarks saying that you object to this bill. Just what in this bill do you object to?
Ms. Guth, here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, the bill adds a step to our process to come back to the legislature after our rulemaking, and the commissioner feels that this would add a step. It adds time to our processes, and it adds cost.
Representative Farquharson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're objecting to is that the legislature has any authority over these fees. Is that what you're objecting to?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Torkelson, that That's not what I said. And, in fact, the legislature in 2009 did pass language that gave the agency authority to raise fees for water. And I can get you the site for that. Not the first time I've had to testify off of my cell phone. Don't know what people did in the old days.
Well, while you're looking for that, I will remind MPCA and members that in your package you also have the two-page biannual MPCA biannual budget for fiscal year 16-17. And on the bottom of page 2, there, the last paragraph under restructuring program fees, it says, and I quote, "We are requesting authority to restructure the fees generated in our water and land programs to mirror the fee funding structure of our air program." So it's clear to me that back then they were asking the legislature for authority, and now we are having a discussion. They admitted back then that they didn't have the authority. Now they're saying that they do. So, Ms. Gauthier, I would say, I'm interrupting Representative Torkelson, but I would say by what authority, other than the governor telling the commissioner and the agency to come here, by what statutory authority do you, why the change?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Torkelson, so the site would be 2009 Session Law, Chapter 37, Article 1, Section 3, quote, "The commissioner shall continue the rulemaking process to better align water and air quality permit fee revenue for fiscal years 10, 11, 12, 13 with the cost of issuing permits, including the cost of environmental review." So we went through the rulemaking process that we were in, and when that went before the administrative law judge, the administrative law judge concluded in her hearing report on that rule that while the legislative grants of rulemaking authority was not specifically clear, that the MPCA's, quote, "interpretation of its authority to cover the full cost of its operation of the air and water permit programs is justified," unquote. And, of course, we already have to cover the full cost of our air permits by fees, and that's a federal law. And that does come before you every other year in the omnibus budget request, and that is something that the legislature sees and it moves forward. So the legislation wasn't maybe specifically clear, but it has been interpreted to by the ALJ to be clear that we do have that authority. The commissioner brought that to the legislature in 2015 because he wanted to work with the legislature, I would guess, but knowing that there is an ALJ decision out there that we do have the authority to raise these fees.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, you know, really the purpose of this bill is to reinforce the legislature's authority. And as I understand it, that is what the department is objecting to.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Torkelson. We are trying to fix a structural imbalance in our budget that has been there for many years.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. But this hardly seems like the avenue to fix it. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the green.
The rest of the testifiers are on deck.
The green bar, which is where a lot of your money comes from for the water quality, for the permit fees. How much solid waste tax, what's the dollar amount of the solid waste tax that is used for the water fees?
Ms. Gauthier.
For the water permits, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. I would like to phone a friend, please.
Sure. Mr. Bunker, I believe.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Committee members.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Joshua Bunker. I serve as the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mr. Chair and members, the amount from the Environmental Fund that is used to support the permitting programs in water, PCA, amounts to right around 36% of the cost of those programs, or $11.7 million. And of the entire water permitting programs, those dollars collected from fees amount to just under 15%. So 36% is from the environmental fund, and so the receipts, including solid waste tax, would be used to cover that $11.7 million amount.
Representative Wagenius.
So bottom line, how much dollar, not percentage, how much dollar from the solid waste tax?
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Representative, $11.7 million.
$11.7 million.
Per year.
Per year.
Okay. People.
That tax was designed to go to counties to manage their solid waste programs. So what has happened here is you're taking from one of your constituencies and giving it to another. So you're taking it from the counties and giving it to some very specific people who are asking for water permits. I mean, basically, that's what's going on here. And there's a question of fairness. And a question of the counties coming to us again and again asking us to use the solid waste tax to support their programs, since that's what the tax was originally intended for.
Thank you. Yep. Next, I'd like to bring down Mr. Johnson, and then Quillis and Kay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Gentlemen, I think I know what your testimony might be, so I'd appreciate it if you could keep it as brief as possible and then be available for questions. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I can be brief. In your packets, there is the copies of letters that were submitted to the Pollution Control Agency during a public comment period. The League's comments about this proposed fee increase discussion are included in there. And just to briefly summarize, we do support taking the time out for further consideration that this bill provides through the DE1 amendment. Generally, we feel that the appropriate first thing to look at when we're looking at overall water programs for the state is general fund and widely collected sources of revenue. Because it is an impact that's coming from everyone in the state, and the permitting necessary, if you use a bathroom in Minnesota, you're one of the people contributing to a need for having a permitting program. If you live in a city that has stormwater, you're one of the people contributing. And so it's very broad. And we think that it's appropriate to first look at whether it's state general revenues and other general sources of funds are the more appropriate way to do this. The League does appreciate the commissioner's decision to take a time out and form this group to work with permittees. We have cities participating in that. We'll continue to do that. And we will continue to have ongoing discussions to identify and clarify how agency staffing has changed over time. We're very sympathetic with requirements and program mandates coming down with no money to implement them. We see that pretty regularly ourselves. So we're happy to talk with them more about where that's occurring. And it could be that a fee increase for some programs is part of what the correct decision is. But we aren't at the point of knowing that yet. And we really think that this needs to have further discussion. This process started after the last budget was completed here as far as bringing stakeholders together to begin discussing this. And so really our first time of looking at a deficit being claimed in their budget was after the last legislative session. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to respond to questions.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Tony Quillis, Director of Environmental Policy at Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'd just like to echo a lot of what Mr. Johnson just said, because any potential fee increase can impact all of our members in various capacities. We agree that prioritizing water quality fees is important, but we think that the approaches and techniques probably will vary as we move forward on that. We at the Chamber believe a comprehensive and detailed review should take place, and any savings and reprioritization should be within dedicated to the Water Division prior to requesting any fee increases. Mr. Johnson mentioned, Ms. Gauthier has mentioned, there is a Water Fee Advisory Committee I was just at the last meeting on Friday, made up of 16 people. Representative Hansen will be happy to know that none of them are lobbyists representing any of the various interests. But just that, we think, is a good venue to go through and have these discussions. It has been some good discussions so far. I don't know how they're going to come through. I think Ms. Gauthier said they're going to come through with some recommendations in August. We look forward to working with them through that process. But I also wanted to point out Representative Torkelson, I think Representative Poston, I know Representative Johnson and Representative Fisher and I have spent a lot of time with the Legislative Water Commission. And we're talking about fees right now. But also, I don't think it's wrong to have the legislature to have a say in what it looks like in the future. And what I'm referencing is there is an interagency reuse task force that was put together by the Department of Health that put together how to reuse water. And I'll give you one example of a DOT project in the city of Woodbury, Washington County, where they went through and took some of these retention ponds and are using that water now to irrigate two golf courses in the city of Woodbury. So when we look at things like that and we want incentivize programs like that, how do we do that? Is it through fees, through other things? So to be forward-thinking and think of technology and things like that in the future of how we look at that and have the legislature have an oversight over that and how we would do those fees, we don't think it's too much of an ask, Mr. Chairman. Stand for any questions.
So you want to make changes? Okay. Mr. Cape. Clavin, you're on deck, and Mr. Gerber, you're in the hole. That's baseball for you folks who don't know. Proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Kay. I'm the Director of Government and Member Relations for the Minnesota AgriGrowth Council. AgriGrowth is a nonprofit, nonpartisan member organization representing Minnesota's ag and food systems industry. Our mission is to advocate for Minnesota's ag and food sectors where we see necessary on behalf of our members. On behalf of AgriGrowth, I'm here to support House File 2940 before you. Consistent with our feedback provided to the PCA last year, also in your packets, AgriGrowth does not feel that a water quality fee increase is warranted at this time. Instead, we would suggest the agency look to reprioritize existing funds, department efficiencies, and eliminate permitting duplicity. Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Clavin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, Bruce Clavin. Today I represent the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association, the Chicken and Egg Association, Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. Many of our members have MPDS permits under this program, so that's our interest here. Our involvement in this, and again I'll be brief, it dates back to 1998 when we first had this conversation with the PCA about whether livestock even needs to be involved in this program. There's two components to that discussion. One, are you a point source? And number two, do you discharge into the waters of the U.S.? We don't discharge into waters of the U.S. We land apply the manure. We've always argued since 1998 that we don't even belong in this program. Not that we wouldn't be regulated, but that we don't belong in an MPDS Clean Water Act permit program. There's been court cases over the years. 2003 was a rulemaking, 2008, 2011. And now we're here again. So our central argument is not so much about the fees as it is maybe they could reduce their workload and not have us in this program. I think it's also important on the larger question Representative Torkelson raised about the rulemaking. They derive their authority from you. They get their funding from you. And certainly it's appropriate for the legislature to weigh in on this from an oversight standpoint. So, Mr. Chairman, we support the bill.
Thank you. Is Mr. Gerber here?
There.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're hiding behind the coffee pot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was sitting in the hole.
You got me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Daryl Gerber. I am the policy analyst at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I'll be really quick, but I am speaking today in opposition to House File 2940. And I'll note that in the packet of comments, you do have comments also from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And within those comments, we actually outline a number of areas in which, because of the low fees, a number of areas which that work has not been done and how it has actually been impacting some of the water quality in the state. But to give a little bit of context, I think looking back 25 years ago when these were last comprehensively looked at, the stamps for mail was 29 cents. And since that time, stamps, the price has increased in order to be able to cover the cost of that program, yet these fees have not covered the cost of the increased inflation as well as the increased requirements placed on the PCA. And in the fact sheet, PCA noted that they currently have a 57% backlog in the municipal wastewater permitting program and that some programs are only able to do the bare minimum of the required permitting work. And the other thing, too, I think that we also have to keep in mind is that for some of those programs, they are using clean water funds for some of those programs. And I think it's important to really make sure that they continue to have the fees in order to cover the cost of the programs to avoid the possibility of using those clean water funds inappropriately as a substitution for those long the actions that are covered by the fees that have been around since before the clean water fund. So in closing, I ask that a vote no on this and pretty much to allow the current process that has been started to complete, finish the engagement with the stakeholder work group, and continue with the proposal to address this shortfall. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Bunker with the MPCA, if he's still here.
If all the testifiers would be in the hole somewhere.
My question, Mr. Bunker, is when the fees that you receive do not cover the overheads of the agency, before you look at raising fees to taxpayers, do you ever look at reducing your overheads? To operate within the fees that you do receive.
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not familiar with all of the reviews that happen within the various seven permitting programs, but certainly as we go through our annual spending plan process and review resources available, we determine the best course of moving forward to accomplish the objectives that we have set before us. So we do our best within existing resources to accomplish those program objectives. And further than that, I have to refer you back to our directors of those programs.
Representative Colston.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is also for Mr. Bunker, and you probably want to have Ms. Gauthier come down as well for this. We'll give her a second if she's still
there. She's there. Oh,
there you are.
She's hiding behind the desk.
Even better. I got Representative Lewick's head right there, so sorry about that. The question that I have is for the NPCA, give me your best answer. I'm not asking for an exact answer, but how many lawsuits has the NPCA engaged in and settled approximately in the last 3 years?
To the testifiers. Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Neuberger, I am sorry, but I do not know and I do not have that information, but I'm happy to get it for you.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. I happen to know that you have been, that the MPCA has been involved in several. I'm not going to dig into the details, so the next question would be the settlements that come from those lawsuits, some of them have been significant. What happens, please remind the committee, what happens to the money that the NPCA brings in from these settlements?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Neuberger, members, I would also need to get back to you on that, Mr. Chairman. I do know, for example, it's different depending on the type of lawsuit. So, for example, there was just a settlement between the Attorney General and the 3M. Company for contamination of groundwater in southern Washington County, and that was a natural resource damages lawsuit specific type of lawsuit under federal and state Superfund. And so there's specific statutes that tell exactly what happens to that money. But not all of the lawsuits are natural resources damages lawsuits. So I don't know exactly what happens when it is not. I'm just familiar with that type, but I'm happy to get that information, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. Then my final question would be, so by default, just refresh the committee's knowledge base here. So by default, when you settle these lawsuits, this money does not go back into the general fund typically. It goes to other MPCA designations. Would that be correct?
Ms. Gauthier, Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Neuberger, it would have to be examined by case-by-case basis because sometimes those lawsuits are from stipulation agreements, or those legal actions are stipulation agreements, and those are, again, under the Superfund law where the agency is charged with, when there is contamination, we are charged with trying to recover the funds from the polluter. And so when we do recover those funds, then those funds go into, I believe, a fund that is used to clean up generally those funds. But, Mr. Chairman, I believe it's case by case depending on the lawsuit, and I'd be happy to get that information.
John Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my final comment here is that, to my knowledge, that yes, you are correct in some regards. I also know that not all of the money that you bring in goes directly towards cleanup and restoration. I do know that some of the money that comes in goes to different areas of allocation within the MPCA, and I would be very interested to see a synopsis of the last 3 years of the number of lawsuits the MPCA has settled, the amount of money they've brought in, and where that money has gone specifically. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, point of information, Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Neuberger. Initially, you said the last 3 years. Is that what you would like for the last request also?
Representative Neuberger.
Yeah, I could make it real difficult and say the last five, but I'll be happy with three.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had a question for Mr. Quillis and Mr. Clavin.
Okay. They are trotting to the witness table as we speak.
They weren't in the hole.
Yeah. I should have told them to be on deck.
On deck.
That's my fault. Okay, now they're at the plate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They're both smiling, so I think they're ready. Mr. Quillis, and I think you might have referenced me while I was out of the office or out of the room here. You had mentioned about not having lobbyists on the task force, but it looks like it's a stakeholder smorgasbord. Are those meetings, are those public meetings, are there minutes from them, are there is there documents for the public to see what's happening in those in that task force that's working on this?
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members, I can comment from my personal experience on it, and the PCA can comment. I know that I'm pretty sure there is a website set up. I know I get notifications for the public meeting. They are publicly noticed. The agendas are on there. The handouts were on there because I know I printed them out for Friday's meeting. So as far as I know, yes, they are all public, and there is on the PCA's website all the documents and minutes from previous meetings available.
And for the thousands of people who are listening today, there was lots of head nodding in the back there from pollution control. Affirming that, yes, they are public.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Quillis, so with those, does the group operate by consensus or by voting?
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's been three so far. I have only attended two of them. They've been more presentations and overviews so far. There hasn't been any voting or consensus. A lot of background and information that's been going on so far.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Clavin, when I was listening to your testimony, you were talking about what happened back in 1998, and maybe to refresh folks, that was during what was referred to as the feedlot wars, which is 20 years ago now. We were all much younger then. But so what happened in the feedlot wars is you had a tenuous compromise that was put together, of which this was part of it. Is that correct?
Yes.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members from the record, Bruce Clavin, the Several Livestock Group. Yeah, so you're correct. Back in 1998, as referred to the time as the feedlot wars, what was going on at that time was a major rewrite of the rules. They're referred to as the 70-20 rules because that's the chapter they're in. Prior to that, the rules were about 8 pages. They had been there for a number of years. And there was a major rewrite. I think they went from 8 pages to probably 40, 50, something like that. Lots of permit requirements and so forth. The conversation in 98 also involved the Clean Water Act. That's where this came from. Were you a point source or not? And so, like I said, there were two tests, a point source and a discharge. And it's easy to use Mr. Johnson's clients. You have the wastewater treatment plant, and then you treat the water and discharge it under your permit into the waters of the U.S. That's compliance with the permit. We don't do that. So the discussion we had in 98 was, are you a point source? And under the Clean Water Act, yes. If you're over 1,000 animal units, you're defined as a point source. The other part of the test was never met. We don't treat the manure and discharge it into the water. We're prohibited from doing that. So whether it was a compromise or not, I don't know if I'd go that far. We made this argument in 98 that we didn't discharge, so it was the wrong permit for us. We never argued that we shouldn't be regulated. If the government needs to know where the manure goes, we could do a feedlot registration program. There is some of that. But this over the 1,000 animal units or not is where the permits came in. And so that's what was going on back in 98. The EPA rewrote the rule in 2003. There was a lawsuit called Waterkeeper Alliance. Livestock group said the rule went too far. The environmental group said it didn't go far enough. They were consolidated. There was a ruling in 2005. Then EPA went back to the drawing board in 2008. A new rule came out. There was another lawsuit. It was settled finally in 2011. In 2011, we approached the legislature and changed it to be in compliance with the federal law. But it's still the MPDS program. Long story here. Answer, but it does date back that far, which I have.
To the point of long story, members, we do have one more bill to do today, and there is another committee that will be meeting in here soon, and I do want to get this wrapped up, but this is an important topic, so Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Clavin. So I wasn't clear of where you were going, if you were recommending that, separate from the fee issue, opening up the feedlot rules and law, if you're proposing that.
Mr.
Chairman,
quickly, I don't know if I'm recommending opening those up necessarily, but back in 2011, we did have the conversation about, once the federal court ruling came, I think you were here at the time, I know we discussed the bill, about doing something other than being in the MPDS program. That would really be where we are, because then we're lumped into this whole conversation about costs and for permits we can't use.
Representative Bliss, you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I appreciate all the discussion that's going on regarding the need for these fees, but if we refer back to my bill, and I believe that's what we're here to discuss, there is a difference in opinion between MPCA and the legislature that they have the ability to raise fees without legislative approval. And my bill simply states, does not go into the need for any of this, and I don't doubt that there's a need to raise some additional revenue. My bill simply states that, it's clarifying existing law 116A 1283, that no administrative agency can raise fee without legislative approval. That's all my bill does, and I understand the chairman's need for brevity here, but I just want to bring us back to what my bill states, and we can have this discussion on a budget year, and I'm sure we will. But just to remind the committee that is what my bill is.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that Mr. Gerber actually had a good analogy relating to the Postal Service, because I think what would happen if we had to have Congress raise the stamp rate every time. Congress couldn't pass a bill to do that, and to raise the stamp every time. And if we had to do that, we're not in session. I mean, we have a very abbreviated session right now. The reason we're rushing is we didn't start it very early. We have a lot of work being done in a very short period of time, and the legislature is not in session very much. Just finally, with Mr. Clavin on the feedlot rule and fees, and because you do have the 1,000 animal units, but we do have requirements for less than that. Back in 1998, we did not have a cervid industry, and now we do, and it's my understanding there aren't any cervid farms that have any feedlot permits. And so when you have changes, things that weren't anticipated over 20 years, you know, if you open up the law
there's maybe other things that should be looked at as well to make sure that we're protecting the environment and have equity in terms of regulation to protect the environment and to protect the industry.
Representative Wagenius, you get the last word for last comments.
Real quickly, Mr. Quillis and others are driving for general fund money to pay for the cost of the permitting. If it's general fund money, then the stakeholders are the citizens who pay taxes. So my question for the Pollution Control Agency is, what portion of the folks on the stakeholder committee are people paying the fees, not those receiving the benefit?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Representative Wagenius. When the commissioner set up the fee advisory committee, he had two requirements for members of the committee. One, they could not be a registered lobbyist. But two, he wanted to hear from people who are fee payers. So everybody on the group is a fee payer, but they are, of course, also members of the public.
The fee payers are the citizens of Minnesota. They should be on this committee. I don't know why we think that stakeholders are the ones, the beneficiaries are on your stakeholder group, not citizens who are paying. That makes no sense.
Thank you. Representative Bliss, I'm going to renew my motion. You did a great job of bringing us back to what your bill is all about. So I'm going to renew my motion for House File 2940 to be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Okay. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Next, Representative Lehman. The intention of the chair is for House File 3440 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lehman. House File 3440, welcome to the committee. Welcome to the table.
Welcome to the table. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and thank you for getting us in under the bell here. I don't think this will take long. What I'm offering with House File 3440 is a pretty simple bill. Minnesota has 22,000 miles of snowmobile trails, and 20,000 of those snowmobile trails are grant and aid trails. And as I think most of us know, those grant and aid trails are kind of a partnership between the public and private clubs that maintain those trails with their volunteer work. So my bill today simply makes it clear that no less than 60% of revenue deposited in the snowmobile trails and enforcement account must be expended for grants and aid to develop, maintain, and groom the trails and acquire easements. Current law has the money in the account from snowmobile registrations and state trail sticker fees available for the grant and aid trails. My bill would change that to 60% of the entire account. So the entire account, in addition to the sticker fees and registrations, would include revenues from unrefunded gas taxes that are attributed to snowmobiles. And with me here to also talk about this bill is a well-known Doug Franzen from the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association.
Mr. Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Franzen, if I'm not so well known. One anecdote before I talk. I'm not doing my Barry White imitation. I may sneeze at some point. I have what I refer to as the plague. I may have been poisoned by the Russians, or I have a severe cold. I'm not sure which it is. but on a condition of, hearing this bill, Representative Lehman said I had to go to the doctor. And so to get this bill through today, I am going to the doctor immediately after this. Minnesota, members, Minnesota has the finest snowmobile trail system in the United States. It was a system largely built and maintained by volunteers in relationship with the Department of Natural Resources. We enjoy a love-hate relationship with the agency. I think they feel the same way about us, but as far as working together, I think we may be probably better than a lot of stakeholder groups agencies deal with. The DNR approximately at this point spends 40% on their activities and distributes 60% of the total revenue to the grant and aid system, snowmobile clubs. We would like to maintain that percentage, and it's approximate. It goes a percent here, a percent there, but it's kind of the benchmark. And with the 40% DNR has, about 15% goes to enforcement, which we support, and about 25% goes to parks and trails. That's not all administrative. The state DNR grooms and maintains approximately 900 miles of the system for the state trails, a big disparity from the 20,000 miles the volunteers maintain. But in fairness to the DNR, these are in northeastern Minnesota, where it snows more than it does in Worthington. And so it takes a little more grooming in that. This is a bill that we came forward with last year. It was discussed. It was, I don't recall, Mr. Chair, if it was in the House bill or not, but it was an item of conference committee. There was some informal agreement. This seeks to formalize that. I will note that last year also Representative Eklund and I believe Representative Nelson came forward with a bill requiring no less than 65%. And again, while we think that's a tremendous idea, our thought is 60%. And I will disclose, Mr. Chairman, we are meeting with the DNR tomorrow. And hopefully we can come up with a memorandum of understanding, and if we are successful with that, the need for this bill, you know, may go away. But it's a terribly complicated system. At this point, it's a mature system. Things are changing. We've had uneven snow. So there are challenges for users and for the DNR as well. We hope to work those out, but we're not quite there yet.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Friends, and for the breakdown of where the money spent. I found that very helpful. But my question related to that is, like, what's the process for allocating these funds? Like, who makes the decision? How does it work exactly?
Mr. Friends.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein. Initially, well, first of all, a club and has to get, you have to be part of the system. And the state does not disperse money directly in relation to the club. It's a grant and aid to local units of government. So a county or a city or, you know, a town may be the sponsoring agency that actually is in relationship with the state. They have to have that contract. There are annual contracts with the state, and the snowmobile club actually performs the work for separate relationships where in issues like insurance and indemnities, those types of things with the local units of government. But what it really does is maximize the decision making at the local units with the local elected officials in partnership with their community members in the snowmobile clubs. Once they are in the system,
they get the club or the county, the grant, if you will, is certain dollars per mile, and it's we have what's called rate zones. That dollars per mile is significantly higher, say, in Chair Fabian's district than it might be on the Iowa border. And I think it could range from approximately $750 per mile to $250. DNR would probably be better with the exact numbers. And you get the money based on the rate zone, based on your contract. The system is what we call performance system, in which you get the money every year. If there's a lot of snow, you have to maintain this adequate level of grooming to do it. If there's no snow, you put the money away for the next year. So you may have excess funds one year. You may have not enough funds the next year. And the theory is it evens out. One of the issues is that the evening out, we've had kind of lean winters lately, and that's one of the issues we're exploring with the DNR. Do we have the best system now? I don't know. But regardless of which system we have, we think the proportionality of what money should go out to the volunteers and the local units of government throughout the state should be fairly constant, because it's extraordinarily efficient use of, I would say, public funds, but we like to say our funds, snowmobilers' money. Because, again, this is a user fee dedicated fund paid for by Minnesota snowmobilers.
Governor Hornstein.
Thank you. I have no further questions, just a comment. I mean, I think here we're now seeing as the climate changes, this program now has to be changed as well. So just an observation, Mr.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. President. Real quick. So you talked about the allocation of funds to different clubs.
Yes.
So in the areas where we have are blessed, I would say, with lots of snow, is there a way to access the funds to clubs that are maybe not so blessed with lots of snow, or do their accounts keep building up?
Mr. Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Eklund. That's a huge question. It's one we're going to be talking about. The current way to deal with that is a recognition that there is more snow in the northern part of the state than there is in the southern. So there is that rate differential. But what we have found out is weather can be fluky. Boston and New York have gotten most of Minnesota's snow this year. That's unfair. It's a cruel trick of God, because they don't want it and we do. Both the blessing and the curse of being a statewide organization with a statewide system is there are stakeholders in southern Minnesota, stakeholders in northern Minnesota, and as Representative Eklund will tell people, when there's no snow in the south, people trailer up to his district and others' district and recreate in the northern part of the state. The question I have no answer for. It's a question that we and the DNR talk about every time we meet. What is the fairest allocation between areas of the state? We're going to continue talking about that tomorrow, but it's not a problem I think we can solve today, Representative Eklund.
Representative Eklund, I have a question for you real quickly. In the bill that you had last year, what was your intention on how that should be split? Is it in line with what we're talking about here, or was it something else?
Mr. Chair, similar to what we're talking about here.
Thank you. And that was my intention, too, as chair of the committee last year. But I think DNR, Barb, I'm sorry, Ms. Julie, there you are. Oh, you're hiding behind the coffee pot.
Round up.
Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Barb Julick, and I'm the CFO for the Department of Natural Resources, and I'll be quick given your time. I think as Mr. Franson testified, you can see that managing the snowmobile account program can be very complex. We deal with revenue that fluctuates year to year, not only on weather, which can differ greatly in different parts of the state, and based on renewal rates, which are not a third, a third, a third. Within a three-year renewal rates, it's more like a 20-40-40. So the revenue in the program has multiple variations into it. And to manage that program across the state to meet the state needs, which vary differently in different geographic regions and very differently from year to year is very complex. And for that reason, we would prefer to continue to work with MinUSA on the memorandum that Mr. Franzen referred to and have that process move itself forward versus proceeding with legislation on the topic.
Thank you. Questions, members? 10 o'clock, 27. Thank you. With that, the bill's laid over, and we are